following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Decentralized separate Jewish communities. We're looking at this whole area. We're going to be touching on all of the different things that are surround our little suitcase here. Most of them are very negative. This is not a good period of history either for Europe or for the Jewish people. Before we talk about the Jews, just to look at what's happening in Europe during this period of time. The period of time from the fall of the Roman Empire, we're talking about 476 of the Common Era, until the Renaissance. Renaissance, the date, dates, again, different historians use different dates, but let's say around mid-14th century is the beginning of the Renaissance, which will go till mid-17th century. So let's say 1350, if you want, 1350, the last possible date you'd say is maybe 1650, which is really late. It's really the Enlightenment period. But that period of time in Europe is called the Dark Ages. Now, today, most historians don't use that term. They say Middle Ages. These are, by the way, these terms, Dark Ages, Middle Ages, were all terms coined in the 19th century. It wasn't like, just like with the Byzantine Empire, the Romans didn't wake up one day and say, hey, it's the Byzantine period. People didn't wake up one day and go, hey, it's the Dark Ages. You know, I'll go back to bed for 1,000 years until it gets light again. Most people don't call it the Dark Ages anymore because although it was pretty bleak compared to the height of the Roman Empire, it wasn't as totally devoid of cultural and intellectual creativity as people used to think. There are lots of very good books on the subject. If people are interested in doing reading on medieval European history, I'm happy to recommend some books. But in general, it is a period of time when things are significantly worse for the average person than during the Roman Empire. Rome, for all of its brutality, okay, it was very stable. Now, again, the Roman Empire didn't just disappear overnight. If you know the history of the Roman Empire, Gibbon, the great 18th century English historian, who wrote The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, the classic work on latter Roman history, it takes hundreds of years. It's a huge book because the Roman Empire didn't disappear in a day. Today, things change very rapidly. You know, the Soviet Union collapsed in a couple years. It didn't like get little over 200 years and then disappear. It literally, in the space of 2 years, went from being, it was never a big superpower, they just fooled us into thinking so, into disappearing by 1990, okay? Losing all of its territory, Warsaw Pact dissolved, you name it. In the ancient world, things change more slowly. Rome retreats over a period of time of many centuries, meaning they literally abandon parts of the empire. They abandon England. They start abandoning parts of Northern Europe. Different. Why are they abandoning? Because the empire is crumbling from within and because of external pressure, primarily the great external pressure, which brings about the end of the Roman Empire. External meaning it was rotting from within also. It's like an old tree. Eventually, you just had to lean on it, and the whole thing fell over. But the great external pressure that brings about the end of the Roman Empire are huge influxes of Germanic peoples, okay, we call them Germanic, not they're originally from Germany, they originally come from the steppes, from Asia, Vandals, Visigoths, those guys, who were being pushed by other people, like the Mongols, who had been expelled from China. It's amazing, it's a whole cause and effect thing. They get expelled from China, they migrate across Asia, they push the people who are living in Western Asia out of Asia, and the steppes of Russia, and those guys migrate into Italy and Germany, and they cross the Rhine, and you name it, and before you know, in a couple hundred years, everything's different. So that's like what's going on. By 476, however, that's when the last Roman emperor, who had no power anyway by that, just abdicates. That's the official end of the empire. So it's not like one day you woke up and everything was functioning. The next day you woke up and nothing was there. But in terms of sort of trying to appreciate what it would be like, imagine you're living in the United States where you have a police force and a local government and a post office and a phone system and a public library and a public education. And then, you know, a year later, it's all gone. There's nothing, no central authority. It's a pretty scary thought if you think about it. That which you knew to be the stability of your existence is gone. And that's what happens more or less in Europe. As a consequence of that, first of all, it means economically, the whole stability of the area is greatly affected. Economically, there's a huge economic downturn because trade and culture only prosper in stability, right? Cities do not exist in places where people don't have their act together to have a surplus of food, etc. So people abandon cities. Literally, the population of Rome goes from like 500,000 people to within a few hundred years, like 30,000 people living in Rome. Think about it. Manhattan with like, you know, 15,000 people living in it instead of how many million? Abandon. Why? People go back to farming and trying to just subsistence level existence. So it's a big downturn for European civilization. Central authority is gone. Okay. What's going to emerge out of this, and it's going to emerge over a period of many centuries, is a system which is far more primitive and in many ways more oppressive called feudalism, which is not distinct to Europe. Feudalism is a ubiquitous economic system. You find it in Asia and Africa and the Middle East and you name it. But feudalism is based on basically larger landholders, lords, nobility, whatever you want to call them, making agreements with smaller landholders, lesser lords, lesser nobility, fealty, right? There's like an oath. In Europe, it was the lesser landowner would pledge loyalty to a bigger landowner in case of war. He would pledge a certain number of knights and equipment, okay? And at the bottom of the barrel is the vast sea of humanity, which are peasants or serfs, who are basically slaves, more or less. People who worked backbreaking dawn to dusk, you know, labor, ignorant, toothless. We're talking about a real subsistence level existence. Go see some of those scenes from Monty Python, The Holy Grail. You can see a very realistic portrayal. Now, the absolute filth and squalor. One of my history teachers said it perfectly. He said his defining factor between the Roman period and the Middle Ages was when people stopped taking baths. Literally, people in Europe will stop taking baths for like 1,000 years. They won't bathe. That's it. Imagine what it must have smelled like in medieval Europe. Disgusting. Because the Romans, you know, they had bathhouses and they were into sanitary conditions and you name it. So it's a very, very, very different world. Very different world. Okay? And what happens is it's a huge power vacuum. Out of that, eventually, we'll see strong kings will emerge much later in history. But things are very decentralized, much more backward. Cultural, economic activity, everything is slowed down tremendously. Okay. What, by the way, is the one body that is going to remain as the only unifying body in Europe after the Roman Empire declines? The church. Now, we talked about the rise of Christianity from persecuted sect to official state religion. Once Rome disappears, the church literally viewed itself as the people responsible for perpetuating the Roman Empire in a spiritual sense, not in a physical sense. They didn't view themselves as having legions, although we'll see in the high Renaissance period, the de' Medici popes will have armies and concubines and illegitimate children and be as wealthy and as decadent as the worst Roman emperors ever were, which is going to, of course, cause Protestant Reformation later. But that's a later period of time in history. But the Catholic Church is the one unifying body, meaning, first of all, in terms of their physical control of Europe, they control a tremendous amount of the land. By the 11th century, people like Innocent III, the Pope, will own more of the land in France and Germany than any king or nobleman in France and Germany owns. Huge amount of revenue. And they were big feudal landholders. Okay. Not only that, they had any books that survived. The only people who could read or write in Europe besides Jews were monks. All the copying of manuscripts was done by monks. You ever read Thomas Cahill's book, How the Irish Saved Civilization? He also wrote that not very good book, The Gift of the Jews. But he talks about how... Sorry?
Like that?
No, it's terrible. It has 3 great pages and the rest you should burn. No, it has 3 or 4 of the pages of the nicest things ever said about the Jewish people, and the rest is absolute drivel. But anyway, How the Irish Saved Civilization is a much more interesting book. But he talks about how Irish monks, to a large extent, are responsible for the reintroduction of classical knowledge into Europe. Because talk about a really backward period of time. Tremendous illiteracy, disease, very low life expectancy, incredible poverty, you name it. Not a nice period of time to live in. Now, that's medieval Europe. Jews. Now, Jews, we know, were living throughout the Roman Empire. The Jews, constantly looking for greener pastures and for better places to do business, expanded historically throughout the Roman Empire. Now, as I mentioned before, and we all know from the last class, the vast majority of Jews chose to stay in the Near East. Okay, that was a place which was more familiar culturally and linguistically. It was closer to the great Jewish centers, either Israel or Babylon. Okay. We do know that there's Jews living in Europe. There are Jewish communities living in Europe during the Roman Empire. The Jewish communities in Spain more than 2,000 years ago. And most of the Jews who were living in the Roman Empire, although they did get to exotic places like England and up to the northern borders of the Roman Empire in the Rhineland, the majority of Jewish communities, because to be a Jew you have to have a community. It's one thing to go off and trade in some far-flung outpost of the empire, but to settle, most Jews will settle in the Mediterranean area, okay, meaning on the French Riviera, Spain, southern Spain area, there's Jewish communities there. Jews do settle in Italy, in the Rhineland also, but the community is very, very small. The medieval community, I mentioned, you know, in the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries, 90% plus of the Jewish world is living in the Sephardi world, right, the Arab world, the Muslim world, or pre-Muslim world, Persian world. In the same period of time in Europe, we're talking about only a few tens of thousands of Jews in all of Europe. So it's a very teeny tiny percentage of the population. 15 to maybe, I've seen, no one took a census at the time, like no federations doing censuses, you know, the medieval Jewish federation of the southern Rhineland communities. But we're talking about something like between 20 and 30,000 Jews in total living in Europe. Very, very, very small community. So it's not a place where lots of Jews are migrating to. The rise of the Ashkenazi community is going to be a phenomenon that's only going to take place at the very end of at the beginning of the Renaissance period of time, after the expulsion from Spain. Let's say around the 1500s. Now, what are the Jews doing in Europe in terms of economic, cultural life? There's no question in my mind. It would be a great thing. I've had time to do a PhD thesis. This would be the thing I think I would do it on. I personally believe that to a tremendous extent, the rise of the Islamic world and the golden age of Islam was made possible by the tremendously huge percentage of Jews who lived in that part of the world, and that the Renaissance doesn't take place till later because Europe has very little Jewish community. Okay, I think it's definitely a connection there. You don't like that?
No. There's another author that I read that's actually saying something of an opposite nature, that Maimonides' great philosophical writings was in direct relation to the fact that he lived in Muslim countries and was affected by...
No, Jews are definitely... No, first of all, I want to make it very clear, I agree. Jews live amongst Gentiles, they affect each other. Any honest scholar of the history of Jewish scholarship in the Arab world will know very clearly that not only did these people write in Arabic, and their whole way they definitely had an Arab mentality that affected the way they looked at the world, as anyone who lives in a community as a foreigner will be affected by the community at large. But the other way around, it's a symbiotic relationship in an ideal sense. Yeah. We both help each other. But there's no question also that the Islamic world, especially in places like Spain, did remarkably well because they had a large number of Jews who were allowed to operate freely in their culture.
Economic
and intellectual, which is what I want to talk about, which is a very interesting and little known topic. There's a book by a guy by the name of Karlinsky. I have it. It's not an easy book to read. It's called The Eighth Day, The Hidden History of the Jewish Contribution to Civilization. And it's specifically focusing on Jewish impact in economic spheres and in crafts and all kinds of things which people don't give the Jews credit for, but we know, in fact, the Jews had a huge impact on. Just like in the Islamic world, Jews were very big into trade, going out to the Far East, and into scholarship because we're the only literate people. So too in the Christian world, although we're a much, much, much smaller percentage of the population, Jews are very big in all of the crafts. Okay, craftsmen, where we're talking about metalwork or tanning or you name it. That's a big Jewish businesses working with gold, diamond, things today that Jews do, by the way. A lot of that is still Jewish business, especially Jews from the Middle East. Jews in sciences. We have some of the greatest medieval rabbis were some of the greatest thinkers in mathematics and science, like the Ralbag, you know, people like that. I know a guy who did his PhD on the pure logical works of the Ralbag, if you're into logic, study of logic. We see people like Maimonides, we see in the Arab world. Okay, but there's an idea of the sort of like the Renaissance Jew. Big Torah scholar, great intellect, having a huge impact on the community around him, whatever area. Medicine. This is interesting. You know, my son, the Jewish doctor, this is one of the oldest, I think, points of Jewish nachas in Jewish history. We find Jewish doctors everywhere. Medicine is a uniquely Jewish field. A tremendously disproportionate number of Jews involved in it. Even when Jews are barred from medicine in medieval Europe, almost all nobility will have secret Jewish doctors. It's like Archie Bunker and all. You guys remember All in the Family? He was like this big bigot, you know? But when he had a court case, he wanted a Jew lawyer. Go for the best. I can't stand you. Remember, can't live with him, can't live without him. Can't stand you guys, but I know you're the best. So we have Jews in all of these different fields, in science. One of the besides being hugely involved in trade, and by the way, we're going to see once the Islamic world rises in power, there's going to be a big rivalry between the Christendom and the Islamic world. And they're not going to talk to each other or trade with each other and often fight with each other. One of the great opportunities the Jews are going to seize is going to be the middlemen, because we have Jews trading all the way out to the Far East, Jews living in the Middle East, and Jews living in Europe. And they can all do business because they all know Hebrew. And they're like, it's like having immediate international business connections wherever you go. The best description of Jews in throughout this period of time, the great middlemen of everything. Like I probably said it before, you know, why did God create Gentiles? Someone had to buy retail. So this is what you see Jews doing. But not just middlemen. You have, again, Jews involved in all these crafts and in science. One of the biggest impacts that the Jewish people certainly had is because we were literate, when for Europe to crawl its way out of the Dark Ages, that period of time, a lot of it has to do with the intellectual development of Europe, the rediscovery of classical knowledge. when Europe goes into the Dark Ages, much of that information, when I say classical knowledge, the writing of the Greek philosophers. Greek, by the way, was lost to Europe. It's interesting that in the Eastern Roman Empire, Constantinople, they spoke Greek. There was virtually no one. If you talk about Erasmus, like these great medieval scholars in the Christian world, these people were single-handedly responsible for reintroducing knowledge of Greek back into Western Europe because it basically wasn't known. We're talking about the Renaissance, early Renaissance period. Only with the fall of Constantinople in the mid-15th century did Greek-speaking peoples migrate from the Eastern Christian world back to the West. So even if you had a book in Greek, you couldn't even read it. You know that expression, it's all Greek to me? It's probably where it comes from, you know? People spoke Latin. But even Latin, people didn't have the books. One of the great things the Jews did, because the Islamic world was fascinated with classical knowledge, they had the largest library in the world before they burned it, which was in Alexandria in Egypt. It was burnt later, but it was. What a loss. Yeah, well, no, some fundamentalist Muslims. There's always, you see, in the Islamic world, there's been a great pull between the more enlightened side and the more fundamentalist side who believe you should only study the Quran.
And you have the same.
Right now, I'm not saying we're guilty of the same things also. I mean, we have fanatics in the Jewish world also. But the Islamic world translates all of these documents, with a lot of help from Jews, you can be sure, into Arabic. Those books, in turn, are sent by Jews to Europe. The Jews who take books in Arabic, translate them into Hebrew, send them to Europe. Jews in Europe would translate them from Hebrew back into Latin, or in some cases, Greek. Mostly Latin, because that's the language of Western Europe. So Jews are not only the middlemen of trade, but to a large extent the middlemen of knowledge. There's no question in my mind that to a large extent the Renaissance was made possible by Jewish people being used as translators and scribes. And we have examples. I'm not just speculating wildly. We know for a fact that in the early Renaissance period, there was a big upsurge in interest in Hebrew and in some of these big Renaissance scholars interacting with Jews. So it's like the unsung story of Jewish interaction. But the point to focus on, it's a huge topic, is not so much the specifics of what Jews did, but the fact that Jews were allowed more or less free reign in Europe during the first several centuries after the fall of the Roman Empire. There's definitely going to be hostility towards Jews. We're not talking about Jews living amongst an enlightened population of well-read, well-educated, upper-middle-class people. We're talking about your average toothless, illiterate, superstitious, half-pagan, half-Christian Gentile who's running around Europe at the period of time. So the Jew's going to look like a pretty weird guy. It's going to be fertile ground for all of the stories and ridiculous accusations against the Jews. But we don't have really open anti-Semitism at the time. Interesting, by the way, legend as to how like the Ashkenazi community of Europe, besides those people who may have been left from the original Roman times, how did Ashkenazim, like this, which, who, by the way, early period of time in after the fall of Rome, they weren't called Ashkenazim. Ashkenaz is the word for German. They would call them the Tsarfatim. The Jewish community of Europe was called basically the Tsarfatim. What's Tsarfat? The French. The French. They were French. Because basically they were in the area of Europe that was mostly French. Yeah.
This time when Jews were not collectively oppressed or oppressed on a huge scale, did that have any correlation with the Catholic Church not being as strong or as much empowered?
Definitely. There's definitely a connection. You hear Max's question, he's saying that did the fact that the Jews operate freely have what to do with the power of the church? I would say yes and no. When we get to the Crusades, let me explain a little more. I'll answer that question. There's a couple of legends. I remember talking about one of the great patterns we see in Jewish history is the idea if you want to prosper, you have to have Jews. It's interesting. The Talmud says if you want to be great, rise to power, become an anti-Semite. It's a great way of getting votes. But also the other idea we see, that the original blessing God gives to Abraham, I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. It's definitely clear from even correspondence you can read from medieval Europe that many leaders of communities, whether they be clergymen or noblemen, appreciated the benefit of having Jews. And they also realized if you want to have Jews settle in your community and Jews bring with them more Jews, commerce, intellectual development, craftsmen, you have to have a Jewish community. And if you want to have a Jewish community, you have to have a Jewish religious life. If you want to have a religious life, you have to have spiritual leadership. Jews would not, being not assimilated back then, would not go settle in, as we say in Yiddish, the Gehak Devind, in the middle of nowhere, with nothing there. If there's no pickles, bagels, rabbi, mikveh, yeshiva, I'm not going, right? Bookstore, whatever it is, I got to have it. So it's interesting. There's a couple of very interesting stories. One is that the fall of the Roman Empire emerges in the 8th century, the Holy Roman Empire, which comprised part of Italy, Austria, Germany, people like to say about the Holy Roman Empire, which ceases to exist around World War I, but the last vestiges of it end. But the Holy Roman Empire, all historians like to say, it was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. But the person associated with the founding of the Holy Roman Empire is a guy by the name of Charlemagne. okay, who was originally one of the descendants of these Germanic wandering nomadic peoples. But there's a legend that says that in 787, Charlemagne actually asked the caliph, he contacted the caliph over in either Baghdad, I'm not sure, in Persia, which who we're exactly talking about, and asked them to send a rabbi or two over so that they could establish a Jewish community. Because once they have a rabbi, we'll have a community. And that's one of the legends, is that this Rabbi Colimonius, which is where the name Kalman comes from, settles in the Holy Roman Empire and a nucleus community forms around him. The more interesting legend is another legend about sending this Rabbi Mechir, similar story. We don't know which of these are true or not. But there's a more interesting story of the four captives. In 960, there's a story about four rabbis who go on a fundraising trip. It seems to be the perennial problem of Jewish education, not enough funds. And going on fundraising trips in the 10th century was a little bit more hazardous than taking a business class flight on an LL to Brooklyn. It involved going away for months and months and months, and possibly being, since there's no Roman Empire, you can have pirates all over the Mediterranean, and that's exactly what happens. These four rabbis are captured by pirates. One of the most common pieces of correspondence we find in places like the Cairo Geniza. Are people familiar with the Cairo Geniza, by the way? Cairo Geniza, you know what a Geniza is? A Geniza is a repository of manuscripts. When things have God's name on them, you can't throw them out. You have to treat them with respect. And they're put away in a room. They can be buried, like a Torah scroll that is you can't use anymore. You can bury it. In the last century, in Cairo, in an old synagogue, was found a huge repository of thousands and thousands of bits of books and letters and correspondence. It's, besides the Dead Sea Scrolls, it is hands down the most significant collection of Jewish literature ever found, dating, covering the whole medieval period in the Middle East, like 1,000 years. And we find letters from this period of time talking about ransoming pigeon shvuyim. It's going to be, unfortunately, a very common aspect of Jewish life in the Middle Ages, whether in the Middle East or in Europe, of people being either taken by pirates and then sold as slaves or ransomed on slave markets. Or just ransomed. I got this guy. If you want him back, give me X amount of money. Or even during the Crusades, we'll see that, you know, people, as part of the booty of war, you take people. And everyone knew that the Jews, who, by the way, have this incredible sense of social responsibility, do not allow Jews to live as slaves amongst Gentiles. And they will ransom them back. So we have all kinds of examples of this happening. This is one of the most famous stories where these four rabbis are taken by pirates and ransomed, and they're very expensive. These are valuable guys, so their price was a little more expensive than the average person. And different communities, Jewish communities, ransomed them back, contingent on these rabbis settling in their communities. One of them goes to Alexandria, one goes to Tunisia. There's a tradition that the Rabbi Nosson HaBavli, Rabbi Natan the Babylonian, goes to Narbonne in France and starts a yeshiva there. It's interesting. There's the Sephardic roots of Ashkenazi culture in France. So that's one of the traditions we have. So we have the emergence of certain communities living in specific places in Europe. Again, mostly southern France, the Rhineland today, where the Cannes Film Festival is. That whole area was a very early Jewish community, although I think far less exotic than it is today. Not the same cultural life, I'm sure. That's where Rashi is from again, southern France. The other great area of Jewish settlement, anyone know? The big area where Jews live, more than anywhere else in Europe, is on the Rhine. Well, Spain is not Christian at the time. This is Muslim Spain. The Rhine had three cities, which we call them the Garlic Cities. How do you remember their names? What's garlic in Hebrew? Anyone know? Shum, very close. Shum, meaning Shin Vav Mem, referring to the three cities of Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. Mainz. Okay, the Garlic Cities. Which we're going to see, they're going to get destroyed mostly in the First Crusade. But my family, for instance, Spiro, according to what I've been able to find, originates in Speyer, okay, the city of Speyer. So I'm originally, I guess, a Yeki, even though my family's from Poland. So I guess it makes my Yichus confusing. Okay, so here we have a small Jewish community, very economically and intellectually vibrant, no open anti-Semitism for the first 5 centuries after the fall of the Roman Empire. Doesn't mean there weren't instances of violence against Jews, but no state-sponsored terrorism, no church-sponsored pogroms, none of that's going on yet. That's not going to last, of course, because as all situations we see in the Jewish world, we should always be worried when things are too nice, because when... Yeah, it's a long time. We have a Jewish history. We throw time around in Judaism like, you know, 5 centuries in the Jewish world. Doesn't mean it was ideal. I'm not saying it was a perfect existence. But as diaspora communities go, it's going to be far more tolerable than what's going to happen from the 11th century onward, or the late 11th century onward, I should say, when it's going to be absolute hell for the Jewish people. And again, there definitely instances, there are anti-Jewish riots, there are decrees, there is persecution, but not on the level. It's a low level compared to what happens later. This period of time, by the way, once we get to after, it's 11th century onward, the next group of rabbis that we're dealing with are called the Rishonim. Okay, so this is a very important group of rabbis to keep straight in your mind. We talked about Gaonim and Tanayim and Amorayim. Rishonim are going to go from 1038, which is the date I told you, which is the end of the Gaonic period, the death of Rev Chai Gaon in Babylon, to about 1439, middle of the 15th century. Okay, and this is, by the way, a bad period of time. You wouldn't want to live as a Rishon. It's like living as a Tana was difficult, or living as an Amora was even more difficult. But a Rishon was a very difficult time. It's going to correspond to the worst periods of anti-Semitism in Europe. Rishonim that we know of, just to throw out a few names, Rashi, the Rambam, those guys. Okay, these are Rishonim. There's a lot of them. Rabbeinu Tam, tons and tons of these guys. What's significant about the Rishonim is these are the last people who are going to have an unbroken chain of tradition, rabbi to student, going all the way back to Moses at Mount Sinai. And the end of that period is going to correspond with pretty much just prior to the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, which is going to be a big 15th century is sort of a major line in Jewish history. And the end of the Rishonim corresponds to just a few years before that, when the whole situation in the Jewish world is going to take a big decline. What's most important to remember about the Rishonim, by the way, is how we learn halacha today. If you guys make it all the way to the Smicha program and you learn about Hora'ah, the art of deriving halacha, the way a Jew today, if you want, you can do this. Any of you can do this. You got to read Hebrew first, but you want to learn Hora'ah, how you learn halacha, you follow a Rishon's opinion of the Talmud. Okay? You can say, I hold by Rashi in this opinion, I hold by the Rambam in this opinion, I hold by whatever. Why? Because the Rishonim have an oral tradition that goes back to Mount Sinai, and therefore it's a valid tradition to base their interpretation of the Talmud on. So this period of the Rishonim is a very significant period of time. In terms of what's going on, you have to go? Okay, no problem. Have a good day. It's a very bleak time in Jewish history at large, but it is one of the most creative periods of time in Jewish history in terms of intellectual scholarship, which is a very interesting pattern, by the way, we see, that most cultures in history, you know, to compare, I have a great case. Look at the African-American community in America. Okay, these are people who had a horrendous, they were brought over as slaves, their family structure was destroyed, they lived in horrendous conditions, and they never recovered, by the way. That's a community that has never recovered. Okay, one of the most interesting facets, and it's a tremendous testament to Jewish derive, is that the Jewish people not only have survived some of the most adverse situations, far worse than almost any other people have gone through, but have maintained their infrastructure, their family infrastructure, their social infrastructure. And not only that, we see some of the greatest periods of Jewish creativity correspond to some of the worst periods of time in Jewish history. You're going to see during this period of time, people like the Rambam and Rashi, and what they're able to do in some of the most disastrous situations is absolutely amazing. It's really, really impressive. So I want to look at a few of the personalities now, because we're right in the middle over here of our little chart. First of all, a person we have to talk about is a guy by the name of Rabbeinu Gershon, who had the name, full name, Rabbeinu Gershon Maor LaGaola. Rabbeinu Gershon, the light of the diaspora, who lived, we don't know his exact dates. Most people say 960 to around 1028. Okay, now Rabbeinu Gershon was really the great Torah scholar of European, he's pre-Rishonim, he's at the end of the Gaonic period. Pre-Rishonic period. He's best known for a number of takanot that he made, rabbinic legislative decrees that he puts in place, which have a huge impact on the Jewish community. Anyone knows his most famous decree? It's very well known. He's the one who outlaws polygamy in the Ashkenazic world. Jewish law allows for more than one wife. He, for whatever reasons going on in his mind, decides that that is no longer something the Jewish people can handle. You're all upset. You can go to the Sephardi world. There's Jews who came in this 1948 from the Middle East who had more than one wife still. Today, Israel does not allow polygamy either. But very, very significant character. Not to say too much about him, but you can read up on great Torah personalities. He's one of the biggies. A person I do want to say a little more about, because he's directly related much more to the way we study today, is Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzchak, Rashi. Okay, that's an acronym. You know these names, all these guys' names work? They're all acronyms. They're the first letters of all of their names. Jews not having last names. You notice Jews don't have last names here? Jews don't get last names until much later in European history. Primarily, they're given last names in the last couple hundred years as a way for the Gentiles to keep track of them so they could tax them. Really, that's the basic reason. It's most throughout Jewish history, you had your name and the name of your father. Or you maybe took the name of the city you were from. Okay, but you didn't have like a last name. That's a very recent thing in Jewish history. But Rashi is an incredibly significant character. Again, he lives in Troyes in southern France, in the Riviera area. He is a classic example of what the religious Jewish community used to be like, which is people who were all working, and many of them were very successful, or big scholars in different fields, and were also at the same time great scholars. It's a kind of Jew that we don't see in the world too much today, unfortunately. Rashi was a vintner, first and foremost. He made wine. Okay, he was had a successful wine business. He was born in Troyes, and he went to study in Germany. He came back at age 25 and opened a yeshiva up at the same time as he was running his business. Okay, now he doesn't have sons, Rashi. He has two daughters, Miriam and Yocheved, who are apparently incredible Talmidot Chachamot, like big scholars. You have a father like Rashi, you can imagine. They were really heavyweight Torah scholars in the history of great women scholarship. Rashi is very significant because he does two perushim, two commentaries, which all of us will study if you stick around yeshiva. First of all, he does the most basic commentary on the Bible. He has an absolutely encyclopedic knowledge of the Bible, incredible knowledge of the Bible. He knows everything inside and out. And by the way, he speaking medieval French is, scholars of medieval French will study Rashi's commentary because it's such an excellent example of medieval French. Very interesting as a side benefit of Rashi to the history of language. Sorry? He had a complete encyclopedic knowledge of Torah. It's very clear. What Rashi does, by the way, just for his commentary, is Rashi is answering the most obvious questions you should be asking when reading the text, which is why he's so basic. You should be asking Rashi's question. He should look down. He should be having the answer. If you're thinking when you're reading, you should be asking the question he's answering. Very interesting. The other thing that Rashi does, which is so significant, is that he does, almost on the entire Babylonian Talmud, a commentary, which appears on the inner left margin of virtually every page of the Talmud. Okay, which is absolutely indispensable, because as we move further and further away from Mount Sinai, just as the Mishnah was put together to keep us from forgetting the oral law, and the Talmud was to further elucidate the Mishnah, which wasn't clear enough anymore, so too is Rashi's commentary absolutely essential for understanding Talmud. You can't, as when you guys start learning Talmud, you can't learn it without Rashi. Okay, and we just appreciate it. You realize what a level of knowledge this man had, living at a very difficult time. Okay, according to tradition, he lives during the... did I give you his dates, actually? His actual years? Okay, Rashi's years, 1040 to 1105. Okay, it's pretty old. List a pretty ripe old age by that period of time. But he lives right through the 1095-96, the First Crusade, which was the slaughter of about a third of the Jewish community of Europe. According to Jewish tradition, as a matter of fact, he met one of the leaders of the Crusade, the French knight nobleman Godfrey de Bouillon. It's a very interesting story that Godfrey asks Rashi what's going to happen, and Rashi says, you're going to go off to France and you're going to be successful. You're going to go off to, excuse me, the Holy Land, you're going to be successful. But in the end, you're going to come back with only two horses. And Godfrey says to him, this is a Jewish legend, that I'm going to come back, and if your words aren't exactly true, I'm going to kill you. Now, Godfrey was a big killer of Jews, so he had no problem with killing Rashi. The story goes that as Godfrey's coming back to Europe after the First Crusade with three horses, he enters the archway of the city of Troyes, and the center stone of the arch falls down and kills one of his horses, you know. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but as they say about you and I, they don't tell such stories. Rashi has students who are going to be known as the Balei Tosafot. Okay, Balei Tosafot, those are the ones who add. They're on the outer margin of every page of Talmud. They're the students of Rashi from primarily the 12th century. Most well known is Yaakov ben Meir, Rashi's grandson, who's known to us as Rabbeinu Ta'am. Okay, he was also a big scholar and a very wealthy businessman. But all of these guys are called the Balei Tosafot. So these are also people living at a very difficult period of time, but nonetheless are tremendous scholars. Paul, you had a question in the back?
No. Question?
Okay. And by the way, there's a number of disputes that evolve between Rashi and his offshoot students. The most famous is over the tefillin, the order of the parchment in the tefillin of your head. Some people today, where you ever watch people switch tefillin in the middle of davening, they have Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. We don't know. It's interesting. They found at Masada, I believe, a pair of tefillin, which was Rashi tefillin, like the same order. Not Rashi tefillin, because way before Rashi, Masada being one of all the synagogues, supposedly. But people like this. It's interesting how the Jews get around everything. They found this pair of tefillin, and the order of the parchment matched what Rashi says should be the order of the parchment and tefillin. And everyone said, that's it. That's proof that Rashi's order is correct. And then this follows where Rabbeinu Tam said, no, you know why it was put in Geniza? Because I had the wrong order of the parchment. So they put it away, and they want to use it. Who knows? Okay. Okay, so that's the Jewish world. We have tremendous scholarship going on, and I want to jump ahead till the end of the 11th century. Now, we're talking about the last millennium. The last millennium is a significant period of time. We should get a little nervous about millenniums. The idea of millennium, a millennia, comes from the book of Revelations, which is a book in the New Testament. And this, at the end of 1,000 years, Satan will be released from prison, you know, and then he's going to wreak havoc on the world. The Christians who bought into the idea of messianic redemption, albeit with their own twist, second coming, as I mentioned before, were very into this idea of their own messianic redemption, linked to a millennia. Now, the first millennia was the year 1,000. As they approached that year, the Christian world, there's a period of time in Christian history called the New Piety, when Christians decide to get really frum, which is bad news. I said it's always best for Jews to live, not amongst atheists and not amongst fanatics, amongst moderately religious people are the best diaspora community for Jews. Okay? Any other way is bad. Atheists, you get Nazis, and the other way you get, you know, Almohades and all kinds of crazy meshuggah from Muslims who want to go on holy wars and stuff like that and crazy crusaders. So right in the middle is what's best for the Jews. So the New Piety focused especially on the historicity of Jesus, the historical nature of Jesus. Suddenly, you know, we got to be more into him and his life, and Mary becomes a really big thing at this time, Jesus' mother. And in focusing on the life of Jesus, of course, they focus on his death and who, of course, is blamed for his death, even though the New Testament says the Romans did it, the Jews, of whom only a few thousand are living in Europe. This is where the notion of Christ killer appears. We're talking about like 1,000 years after the event. This is the first accusations you'll see. Now, that's one thing. So we're going to see a rise in a negative opinion of the Jew based on purely Christian sources, forgetting all the superstition that was believed about Jews, being that they lived such different lives and lived in separate communities, and people believed all kinds of horrible things about them. If we zoom out to the larger picture, we'll see a much more significant event. We haven't talked about Islam yet, but in the 7th century, Islam is born. Islam spreads very rapidly. And then the centuries that follow, Islam is going to take over the entire Middle East, all of North Africa, go into Spain in 711, conquer Spain from the Visigoths. And not only that, it's going to, during the rise of the Seljuk Turks, which is before this period of time, but there are people who migrate in from Asia, will to a large extent take over much of the Islamic world. And they're going to press, being very effective warriors, they're going to be pressing on the borders of the Eastern Christian Empire, which is still in Constantinople, which today is Istanbul, Turkey, which used to be a Christian. The center of the Eastern Christian Empire was the Turkish Empire. I have a friend of mine from college. She's religious Greek Orthodox Christian. She speaks Greek in her home. Really cool. You know, we have a lot in common. It's funny. You speak to religious Christians. I happen to have a lot more in common with religious Christians. We talk about religion than secular Jews. It's very interesting, her whole stand on moral issues and everything. But she still calls, till today, she will not say Istanbul. She calls it Constantinople. You say that she spits when you say Istanbul. You know? She's like, those Arabs. You know? So anyway, so the Seljuks take over much of the Islamic world. They're pressing on the Eastern Christian Empire. It's during this period of time, in 1095, that, first of all, the Constantinople is being besieged by the Seljuks. The Eastern Christian Empire, which, by the way, in the middle of the 11th century, a few decades before, the final split takes place between Eastern and Western Christian empires. There's already Constantine sets up two capitals of the Roman Empire in the 4th century. Then they split into two churches, and the irreconcilable real total division takes place. I believe it is in 1054, the final great schism of East and West. So these sort of two competing Christian worlds are at odds with each other. The difference being that Constantinople is not only Eastern Orthodox Christian, but is also an empire, a physical empire with an army, whereas the Western Christian world is not a physical empire. It backed the Holy Roman Emperor, let's say, but it was purely a religious entity with a lot of economic power and political power because of its status. But it wasn't the same thing. The emperor of the Eastern Empire asks the Pope, Urban II, please help us. Now, this was a really degrading thing, to have to ask for help from those papist Roman Catholics. You know, it was probably very degrading, but they had no choice. So in Clermont, in November, I believe it's November 16th, in Clermont in France, Pope Urban II, in a very fiery speech, of which we have four different versions of, more or less the same, but, you know, calls for a crusade, calls on the nobility of Europe to go help our Eastern Christian brethren and go liberate Jerusalem and the Holy Sepulchre specifically, the supposed burial place of Jesus, the big black dome in the Christian quarter, from the infidel, the Saracen. You know, the Saracen comes from the Greek word to live, those who live in tents, by the way. Or the, as they call all kinds of derogatory terms the West thought of for Muslims, but the infidel was the favorite one. What happens? first of all, Europe is not in a very nice way at this time. We're talking about the height of the feudal period, tremendous poverty, and a lot of people, by the way, the feudal system was based on knights. Knights were landed nobility, to outfit yourself with a suit of armor and a horse, a couple of horses. Knights had to have a few horses because you weighed so much, your horse would get tired, required a fair amount of wealth. You have a lot of these professional soldiers who, by the way, who, when they weren't fighting wars for hire, were jousting or going around and raping and pillaging and causing trouble in Europe. It was in the best interest of people like Urban II to try and get some of these guys out of Europe and go kill other people besides other Christians, and also to do nice Christian things. The Pope issued a decree that anyone who goes off to the Holy Land to fight against the Muslim infidel will have all his sins forgiven. Lahavdil, it's like kind of Yom Kippur, you know, give some tzedakah, do some tshuva, go kill some Arabs and you get your sins forgiven. What happens is, first of all, a lot of peasantry, surprisingly, I think Urban was very surprised by how many people rallied to his cause. A large number of peasants decide they're going to go off, untrained, not soldiers, they're going to go off. They mobilize in a few months and march off to Constantinople. Within about a half a year, a large contingency of about 15,000 armed men, of whom about 5,000 are knights and the rest are squires and infantrymen, also follow behind. What happens? Now, by the way, as this mob of illiterate peasants, you know, is marching through Europe, they got it into their heads, first of all, they needed food. They started pillaging the countryside. But not only that, one of the ideas that was introduced is, since we're marching off to the Far East to kill the infidel there, why not get rid of the infidel in our midst? Let's kill the Jews. And this is going to lead to the destruction of probably about half to a third of the entire Jewish community of Europe. And we're not talking about huge numbers here. We're talking about, you know, something like 10,000 or so Jews slaughtered, but of an entire population of maybe 20 or so. That's a tremendous slaughter. So this mob will march through Europe. Sometimes the local people in the different communities will try and protect the Jews, the local clergy, usually not successfully. I want to read you. This is a report of the attack of the Jew, report of attack on the Jewry of Mainz during the First Crusade, 1096. This is a very good book. This is August Cray. He has a whole series of books on letters written from Jews throughout the ages. He says, the slaughter of the Jews, this is an eyewitness account. The slaughter of the Jews was done first by the citizens of Cologne. They suddenly fell upon a small band of Jews and severely wounded and killed many. They destroyed the houses and the synagogues of the Jews and divided amongst themselves a very large amount of money. When the Jews saw this cruelty, about 200 in silence of the night began a flight by boat to Neuss. The pilgrims and crusaders discovered them and, after taking away all their possessions, inflicted on them a similar slaughter, leaving not even one alive. Not long after this, they started upon their journey as they vowed and arrived in a great multitude in the city of Mainz. Remember, one of the three big Jewish communities in the Rhine. The Jews of the city, knowing of the slaughter of their brethren, fled in hope of safety to the Bishop of Rotherd. They put an infinite treasure in his guard and trust, having much faith in his protection, because he was the bishop of the city. Okay, Jews only being allowed to live in certain cities in Europe with an official charter of the local bishop or the nobleman. And it's in the best interest of the nobleman to preserve the Jewish community for his own financial well-being. So the bishop is allowing the Jews into the city. He placed the Jews in a very spacious hall in his own house that they might remain safe and sound in a very secure and strong place. But Amicio and the rest of his band held counsel and after sunrise attacked the Jews in the hall with arrows and lances, breaking down the bolts and the doors. They killed the Jews, about 700 in number, who in vain resisted the force of an attack of so many thousands. They killed the women also and with their sword pierced tender children, whatever age and sex. The Jews, seeing that their Christian enemies were attacking them and their children and that they were sparing no age, likewise fell upon one another, brother and children, wives and sisters, and thus they perished at their own hands. Horrible to say, mothers cut the throats of nursing children with knives and stabbed others, preferring them to perish thus by their own hands rather than to be killed by the weapons of the uncircumcised. It's very interesting. You see, first of all, another instance of Jewish martyrdom in a very extreme situation, robbing the Gentile of the pleasure of slaughtering the Jew. But we're talking about vicious slaughter of thousands of Jews as this crusader mob marches through Europe, pillaging along the way. They arrive outside Constantinople. And by the way, they're not even let into the city because when the very well-educated, comparatively, the Eastern Christian Empire was much better off, saw the disgusting mob that was wanted to come in the city, they more or less kept them outside the city. And then, by the way, induced them when the spring came to march along and go attack the Muslims, who, of course, they met the Seljuk Turks and are promptly all slaughtered. Okay, the Christian army of 15,000 knights arrives later, beats the Seljuks in a number of battles. We're talking about a very well-organized. These are like Rambo, like Army Ranger guys. These are tough guys. Beats the Seljuks in a number of battles. And then marches down to Jerusalem, led by Godfrey de Bouillon, Robert of Flanders, Robert of Normandy, a couple of big knights. There was very little, no real high first-rank nobility in the First Crusade. We don't have any kings coming along.
This program is part of a series. For the continuation, please insert the next disc.